Working Cows Podcast, episode 253. This episode is brought to you by Kubota, celebrating 50 years of helping people to get the job done right with versatile, durable equipment. Kubota, together we do more.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network. Very excited to be joined today by Jared Lumen. Jared is, of course, the host of the Herd Quitter podcast, very faithfully releasing episodes and just cranking out content and doing a great job and talking to guests and expanding the network of guests who've been on podcasts and stuff like that. And so it's just really good to see him doing that work. And I kind of wanted to just sit down and talk to him about some of the challenges and things that they are dealing with there in Southeast Minnesota and kind of how they're approaching those things, how they're thinking about it economically and how they're approaching their operation and the ways that they are making decisions, not just from a financial perspective, but also from a human resources perspective and some of those things. So very excited to be talking to him today. But as I said, this episode is brought to you by Kubota, and farming demands well-built equipment. Kubota equipment that's proven for over a century. Tractors that are adaptable and versatile. Hay tools backed by a 2-year warranty. Sidekick utility vehicles where durability meets speed. And productive SSV skid steers. Visit your local Kubota dealer for a demo today. So very excited to talk to Jared about their operation, how the history of it, how they came to where they are, and some of the future. What are they thinking about next? What's coming down the pike? Very good conversation. I'm looking forward to having with Jared. So Jared, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows podcast.
Yeah. Happy to join you, Clay. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Been really enjoying watching what you've been doing with the Herd Quitter podcast. How has that been going for you?
It's been a lot of fun, and I appreciate you saying that and listening, because it's, you know, I honestly would never have started if it hadn't been for you kind of paving the way and the kind of working, you know, regenerative grazing cattle kind of podcast world. But you gave me the push and the motivation to get started, and it's been an absolute blast. We were talking a little bit offline there. How cool it's been to connect with people all over the country and the world that you never would have met if you hadn't done something like this, and the people you stay in touch with afterwards. I've absolutely loved it. It's been a blast. And I think it's you that always says it's about the best continuing education program that you could ever have. And that sure is the truth. And yeah, it's neat to be on this side of the mic and not just listening as well, because you get to ask the questions that you want to hear. So I've enjoyed that as well. I probably get a little selfish in some of the questions that I ask that are maybe not as relevant to everyone around the country, but you know, I've got them on the phone and I want to take advantage of it.
Yep, for sure. Yeah. What have been some of the lessons you've learned that you feel like you've learned through the podcast?
Man, well, that's a good question. I mean, I'd say, you know, the kind of the idea behind the podcast, the Herd Quitter podcast, and the mentality is to talk to people who like the Herd Quitter cow that thinks for herself and goes the other direction. Is, you know, we're talking to producers who do that same thing. And so, you know, I'd say that mindset is probably the biggest thing, because a lot of the, you know, I talk to a lot of folks out west in totally different environments that aren't going to be perfectly relevant in practice to my farm here in Southeast Minnesota. But that mindset, you know, of challenging the status quo and thinking, you know, what am I doing that, you know, maybe doesn't make sense, that I'm just doing because it's what we've always done or something like that. And, you know, those are the things that I've taken away the most. And we're really working on trying to improve here. I'd say our grazing management is, you know, I thought we were doing a really good job, and we are. To my dad's credit, you know, he went to the New Zealand in the late 80s, early 90s and learned kind of basic rotational grazing, and had been doing that for decades. And so we were by far ahead of the game, to my dad's credit, not my own. And over the last few years, between the podcast and some of the work that I've done off the farm here with the Sustainable Farming Association, I've seen that there's still a lot of improvement to go on our grazing management side. And it's been fun to kind of experiment and play with that, especially over the last couple of years. Last year was a, you know, for Minnesota standards, a drought that I and, you know, many folks had not seen since they talk a lot about the year 87, I think it was. And it was interesting to see how everything responded and reacted to the management last year versus an average year. It was kind of a, you know, not something I want to go through again, but it was a neat opportunity to witness and see what happens.
Yeah. Are you talking along the lines of grass production lasting longer, starting earlier, kind of in a drought?
So, I mean, the biggest thing was, you know, typically here, we've got this spring flush where we get way more growth in the spring, 60% of our grass in May and June. And if we don't get on top of it, you know, and it goes rank and it's losing potential production capacity, because we'll get three or more grazings off ground a lot of times here. And so what we generally have done is when we're grazing through the fields, when where we started is ready and we're, you know, ready to start over again, we'll make hay on a bunch of the stuff that we have ahead of us to kind of control that excess growth, and then move to the start and we'll move that back into the rotation on the next round or the third round. But last year, with how dry it was, nothing was growing back. We just let it keep going and going. And the forage has got taller and more mature than I think we'd ever seen them before. And we were concerned about feed quality and concerned about smothering out new growth underneath and concerned about a whole bunch of things. And we ended up turning the cattle in, you know, like 220 pairs on 3/4 of an acre and moving them 3 times a day. And they took like 20, 30, 40% of it, trampled the rest. And that was just neat, because we hadn't had, you know, we'd have maybe a half inch of rain. Everywhere else was bone dry. And by the afternoon and days later, underneath that mat of forage was moisture. And a few weeks later, there was this whole new mat. It was like a carpet of new growth, of new plants, of new seedings and stuff. And at first we thought they might be weeds, but they were not. They were, you know, new seeds from all of that, you know, mature grasses that got laid down. And that was, now we're trying to figure out how can we implement that regularly. We don't always want to graze that mature forage and let everything get to that, but maybe every year we need to set aside 20 acres and let it do that and, you know, manage it that way to try and hopefully with rain, it'll even be better yet, you know, we'll have better plant growth on those new seedings. But that was fascinating that we'd never experienced, because we had never been forced to let grass get that mature.
Yeah. Yeah. And are you kind of in a, like a 30 inch precip? Where are you at?
At 36, probably average. Yep. And last year, well, we ended up catching up on rain in the late summer, which was nice, but we were like on pace to be like 18 to 20, which right. I know is probably where your average is. But for us, that definitely throws your plans out of whack when you're planning on 36 and grazing 3 times and you get half of it.
So. Yeah. We get 16 here. That 18 to 20 is another 150 miles east of us.
So. Yeah. Apologize.
Yeah. No, it's all right. It's all right. You mentioned 220 pairs on 3/4 of an acre. Is that's a higher density than normal? I'm assuming.
Yeah. I would say so. You know, gosh, and I don't record the data as much as I should, but I would say usually we're around 1.5 acres. So Okay. Maybe if there's 300,000 pounds of stock density, we're probably around the 100 to 200,000 pounds of stock density on average, sometimes lower, sometimes higher. And it also depends on the time of year too. Early in the spring, we're giving them bigger areas, moving them faster. And you're probably closer to that 40,000 pounds of stock density. And then towards the end of that first rotation, when grass is getting pretty mature and pretty tall, we're up in that stock density to force a little bit higher utilization and more trample, moving them a little more regularly. We also have more time though later in the summer after calving gets over in the planting season and stuff. So
sure. Yeah. And that was a cool, I appreciate the story of adaptive, because that, you know, you can call it 800 different names. Yeah, one of which is adaptive multi-paddock grazing. You know, but that I really think that adaptive piece is an important piece that gets overlooked and left out. And we talk about stock densities and pasture sizes and it sounds like a recipe, but really, you know, that was a doubling of your typical stock density, it sounds like, and it was for the purpose of trying to use
rank forage, and now you're figuring out, help, that might not be a bad idea to do that, you know, in a different place every year. So,
yeah, exactly. And you know, our farm in particular has so much diverse landscapes too, that there's no way we could manage it all the same, give the same amount of acres and stocking rate in the same time of year. I mean, we've got what would be considered like $300+ an acre land rent, highly productive cropland we put into pasture that's much more productive. And then we've got steep hillsides that's, you know, pretty poor. And, you know, a lot of the folks around will do, you know, their best grazing management is just kind of an 8 paddock, move every 3 days, very, you know, prescriptive. And it wouldn't, I mean, it could work here, I guess, but it certainly wouldn't be best. So I agree with you. There's a million names and you can call it whatever you want, but we try to be as adaptive as possible. And that's adapting to the particular pasture we're on, the time of year we're on, the forage types in that pasture, the weather patterns of that year, you know, to our lifestyle too. Like I say, we're also raising some crops. And so we're doing a lot of cultivating and harrowing and weed control on our crops at certain times of the year. We can't be quite as intensive managers on our cattle. So we're adapting to all of the factors, I guess, that we got to manage around.
I was just thinking I should get a little jingle button that's a dumb question alert, because I'm about to ask a dumb question. I'm, as you've probably heard me say, I'm row crop illiterate. So on the organic farming side of that, is there any livestock integration on those acres at all that happens in the dormant season?
That's not a dumb question at all. In fact, the vast majority of people probably wouldn't know necessarily either. And there's, we do, not a lot, not all do. You know, a lot of folks maybe have manure somewhere else, livestock, you know, in back at the barns at home, you know, they're a dairy or something where they can apply manure and get that out on the land, because organics, we can't use like synthetic fertilizers. So manure is a very important part of the organic cropping system. But we try to integrate the livestock into that land base as well, either through grazing crop residues in the fall or rotating that, you know, that acre base into an annual warm season, summer annual. Sorghum sedan grass is the big one that we use, and that's been good for extending our grazing season and kind of managing through our summer slump, you know, that kind of evens out our forage supply chain. And so it's been definitely something that we've tried to do, because I mentioned weeds earlier and stuff. We have a lot of weed pressure, and breaking out of that crop rotation into a forage of some sort, ideally not hay, because hay, you're taking all those nutrients away. We'd rather it into some sort of a grazing program that we can leave the nutrients there and really build soil. I mean, that can be a game changer for the following year's crops. And sure. We try to. Yeah.
Yeah. And so is the weed pressure reduced on those where you've had a cover crop that's been grazed? Is there weed pressure reduced the next year in the following crop, or is it still pretty intense?
Yeah, we've had some fields that were really bad. In fact, I think there was one field where it was like, yeah, this isn't going to produce a crop. We went in and grazed off the corn when it was young, planted sorghum sedan grass, and then did a couple of years of some sort of a warm season summer annual, and then went back to crops, and it was one of our cleanest fields. Like, it doesn't make sense. I don't know entirely how that works, because there's way more seeds out there than we'll ever be able to control. We've got one heck, if there's ever some sort of a value found out of ragweed, will be the most profitable farmers around, no doubt. But that sorghum did wonders for both soil, like, you know, the actual soil health and for weed control. And it's really neat, because the sorghum sedan grass is the big one. It grows like 8 to 10 feet tall and can smother and grow faster than a lot of weeds and smothers them out. Sure. And so that's been pretty good one.
Takes water away and all those things from the weeds, which is usually the opposite.
So
you mentioned some $300 per acre land, and you seeded that back to grass. Is that a perennial grass?
Gotcha. We've done some of that, I've heard of dairies locally this year paying upwards of $400 an acre rent too, and we've got a big one just down the road that who knows.
So my question in that regard then is, kind of, you've been through the Ranching for Profit School, walk me through the economics of that. Is, and I know that there's more to it than just the bottom line money and, you know, what you enjoy doing and you know, what's best for the soil and what's sustainable and all those things. But walk me through some of the, just the way that decision got made, if you can.
Yeah. No, well, it's a, that's the tough question we're still asking ourselves. We went to the Ranching for Profit school this winter, and I was supposed to go in February with my dad and have time to figure out all the numbers. Well, then I got COVID. And so I ended up going right before calving season started. And we haven't really put the time into the numbers yet since. So I don't have a perfect definition or, you know, description of the numbers on that. But, you know, if we, we're fortunate a couple different ways. We focused very hard on not selling anything through a sales barn and a commodity market as much as we can. My wife and I have this grass-fed cattle company where we're direct marketing our, we grass finish our open heifers. Anything that comes up open, we grass finish and market through that as grass-fed beef. Our bull calves, we primarily sell through Faro Cattle Company. We're cooperative producers of Faro Cattle Company. And then we also custom graze dairy heifers. And so we're trying to stay out of a commodity market as much as possible. And that's allowed us to be a little more competitive on our row crop acres, especially those $300 an acre ground. It's still tight. And the other thing is our grazing management. We're working on improving that to where we can increase stocking density significantly. I think we can get down to 1 acre per pair. And that'll still, you know, be a pretty steep grazing cost. But if we can keep our summer grazing to $300, I guess, for the cow. And then we also, our challenge up in the upper Midwest is the winter feed costs. We've been working on trying to reduce that as well by grazing primarily corn stalks, which we have in abundance around here, that we can graze much of the winter. If we can keep our costs down and continue to, you know, sell things at a premium through these various different markets, that helps as well. But, you know, a quick, I guess, rundown of an example, you know, in this area, a lot of dairy farmers feed, you know, custom graze their dairy heifers or custom feed their dairy heifers in feed yards. And the cost per day I've heard is anywhere from $265 to $335 per head per day, the numbers that I've heard. And so, you know, I've heard custom grazers, my coworker is who kind of got us started on this dairy heifer idea. And he's getting $260 per day. And if you can get one dairy heifer on 1 acre for 165 days, that's $429 an acre in revenue generated that you have no overhead in livestock. You have no input costs, very minimal labor if you're moving a large enough group that you can spread your labor over more. And then you just got some fence and seeding infrastructure that you can depreciate over however long you want. And so, you know, it's not as competitive. It's not nearly as competitive as organic row crops, where, you know, my dad had seen in the past anywhere from $500 to $1,000 an acre in net profit. But the dairy heifers, they can come close to competing with conventional row crops, where a $50 to $100 an acre profit is considered a win. So, you know, it's a challenge though, because that's a question that we've been asking ourselves lately is, well, the question my dad asked first when he got back from the Ranching for Profit school is, should we move? and the obvious answer is probably yes. For as far as business is concerned, you know, moving is probably the right answer. but there's other, you know, social dynamics to consider. And my wife and I were kind of talking through that, and she made a good point. She said, you know, think of the last 2 weeks. The last 2 weeks we hung out, this was in the winter, it was a little slower time, so we're not always just hanging out with friends this much. But in that particular 2 weeks, it was like we got dinner with these neighbor friends, Paul and Cheryl, and we got dinner with our friends from college, Justin and Andrea, and we went down to church with my mom, and we stayed the night over at her parents and stuff. And it's like, if we lived in Missouri or Kansas, we wouldn't have any of that. You know, sure, our farm would be that much more profitable, but would it be worth giving up all that? And I think we came to the conclusion that we value, you know, we'll take a lower profit. We still want to make it profitable, but we value family and relationships way too much to give it up for that. But that's maybe a longer answer than you wanted for that.
No, that's great. I liked it a lot. And so is it the winter feeding cost that is the challenge there as far as the profit is concerned, and why Kansas or Missouri might be more profitable? Is that what you're dealing with?
Both winter and the ground costs. I mean, the $300 an acre is probably pretty easily we could find, and we could probably go to the 1100 cow dairy and say, we'll rent you all our cropland for $400 an acre, and he might take it. So, you know, I mean, that makes it tight, but winter is a big one for sure. I mean, I mean, it's tough in our area. We've got a lot of dairies and productive ground, so most of the hay is high quality cropland. You know, it's alfalfa hay. And I mean, if we can find hay for $130 a ton, we're pretty happy with that. Mm. And that, you know, I mean,
yeah,
quick math, I don't even know what that, that's $234 per head per day and feed costs on hay alone. That adds up pretty, that's pretty steep too. So,
yeah, for sure. So you talked a little bit about where you're at, Southeast Minnesota, you're south of the Twin Cities then, and how, where exactly, or how far?
We're right in between, you know, Rochester, Minnesota, and the Twin Cities. We're about an hour south of the Twin Cities and 45 minutes north of Rochester. And it's the rolling hills. You know, it's pretty tough to find a spot to park. We've got a water wagon, and it's pretty tough to find anywhere to park it flat. So, yeah, we're pretty much everywhere it's rolling.
Gotcha. And the water wagon is following the cow herd around, or leading the cow herd around?
Yeah. That's just their water trough, portable water. It gives us a little more bunk space. We turned out of it. My grandpa used to have a feedlot, so we pulled one of his old feed bunks, put some wheels on it, and that's our new water wagon. So.
And is water pumped into there from a over-the-ground water line, or how are you getting water to it?
So I'm very blessed to be able to work with the infrastructure that my dad installed 20 years ago. He put the work and effort into building a ton of permanent fence and water line. So we've got water line running for miles all over the farm, and permanent, you know, high tensile electric fence all over the place. And so we don't have any live water on any of the farms that we run cattle on. So everything is pumped via water. Most of it is above ground, but on the home farm, it's a little bigger. We've got an underground water line running out to the back. So,
gotcha. Mm-hmm. And that's winter water then, I would assume, on the home. They're at home for the winter, where you've got below ground
water.
They're
all over the place. Are they? Yeah. We send them to corn stalks as long as we can. And so we're fortunate that the guy we send them to corn stalks on, that's 10 miles away, has live water on all of his farms. Mm-hmm. So the last three winters, they've been able to go till January 20th or later on stocks, and they drink out of creeks or tile line. And then the cows, a few of the cows the last 2 years, we've actually sent down to Nebraska, and he does it all down there. But when they come back, they go to either this farm or another farm that we have access to a winter of frost-free water, and they'll walk half a mile, you know, potentially back to water, and we'll bale graze from there. So
sure. And where's the bale grazing happening? Is that at home?
Yeah, that's at home. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And yeah, talk to me a little bit more about winter in Minnesota. Just kind of give people that a sense of what that's like and what you guys are dealing with there.
Yeah. So it can be temperatures, you know, I would say on average are probably, I mean, most days are below freezing, a handful above 32, but quite a few are below zero as well. And we've had temperatures as low as like, I mean, I remember it was, my personal ignorance, I guess, it was, I had never not had a tractor start. So I never thought that it wouldn't start. And so the weather, we were looking at the polar vortex, it was going to be 32 below or 40 below or whatever, or something. That was when the cows were going to be out of hay. And I just thought I'd go feed them that day. I shouldn't have done that. I spent 8 hours trying to get the tractor started and had to build a little hut out of plywood boards and tarps and run a Nipco heater under it for 3 hours to finally get it started to feed the cows. But it can be pretty brutal. The cold isn't really so much the problem. Our cattle are always out, wintered out. They can get in low spots or hide behind the bales of hay. The issue for our grazing is the snow, and not even so much the depth of snow, but when we do get those above freezing days and it thaws a little bit and then cat kind of ices over, frosts or freezes over. Is last winter, they were digging through 2 feet of snow, but then a bunch of warm weather came and it melted down to 6 inches and then turned to ice, and they couldn't get through 6 inches of the, you know, crust, but they could get through 2 feet of fluffy snow. It's not the snow depth so much as it is the crust that stops them from grazing for our challenge. And there's maybe a way to get around that, but we haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah. The winter of 2019 was exceptional winter here. And, I remember one time we were coming here to church in the morning, and one of my board members was here, and I think it was a John Deere 7810, so a pretty good sized tractor, and he was pushing snow with it. And there was one drift out in front of the church that had been there for a long time that winter. And he's like, he drove both, he had both front wheels up on top of it. And he's like, I'm pretty sure I could have drove over that thing. But I really didn't want to fall through in the middle of it because it was like 6 feet tall.
And he never would have gotten that out again.
Had to wait till spring. So, I mean, the less extreme version of that is I had a guy one time send me a picture. He was 400-pound guy and he's standing on top of a snowdrift, you know, it was holding him up and he was saying the same thing. He said, the cows will dig through a foot of snow. They'll dig through snow up to their eyeballs, you know, but they, you know, they can't get through this kind of stuff. So that's the challenge.
Well, my dad, I remember one winter when I was in college, my dad was gone and my grandpa was here. And my dad called me up and said, can you go help grandpa dig out a snowdrift over the fence? Cause calves are walking over the fence. There was a 4, 5, 6 foot drift or whatever. And iced over that the 500-600-pound calf could walk right over top of it with their little hooves. Didn't even poke through that. That was something. So,
So what are you mentioned bale grazing, and is that, hay that you guys have raised or is it purchased hay that you're using there?
Yeah, a combination. We a few years back finally did the math on what it actually cost us to produce hay, and it wasn't quite so exciting, I guess. Hay was a big part of our organic crop rotation to kind of on the farms that we couldn't graze and didn't have access to grazing, we'd rotate out of crops into hay. When we did the math, it cost us $156 a ton to make that hay, which is like close to $3 per day to feed a cow, is what we figured. And that hay was high quality organic alfalfa hay that we probably could have sold for $250 a ton. So if we really charged that cost to our cows, it was, you know, it's embarrassing. We were probably feeding $4 a day hay to our cow. And so we kind of came to the conclusion at that point that it does either A, we need to sell the hay and buy back cheaper stuff, or B, we need to stop making as much hay. And so about that time is also the same time when we really focused on trying to reduce hay feeding altogether and extending our grazing season. So we way backed off on the hay we make. We used to make probably 1,500 to 2,000 bales a year, and now we make 700 to 1,000. But at the same time that we reduced the making hay, we reduced the needing of hay, and we grazed stocks later into January. So we thought we would start buying more hay and replacing the stuff we were making, but we've kind of just stopped feeding it. So we still make most of our hay, but we make significantly less than we used to. And most of the hay now is not on set aside alfalfa fields made for hay. It's first cutting off of our pastures that then is rotated into grazing on the second or third, you know, pass through the farm. So I don't know how, we've not really, I guess, done the numbers on what the cost per ton is to make hay off a first crop pasture. You know, I don't know how you allocate the land cost to it and different things, but I guess it's kind of how we manage we don't have a variable stocking rate yet. So it's kind of how we manage our spring flush at the moment. So we kind of see it as a necessary way.
Yeah. So that's kind of the ranching for profit, graze it up deal. You guys, your graze it up is taking that first cutting off gives you an opportunity to get around more acres, with where the cows can't be when it's right and ready. And
exactly.
That is what I was wanting to follow up on that question or on that idea of making hay on those acres that will later be grazed. Will you graze them? That'll be more like a second cutting. So would that still get grazed pretty early, just given your environment and where you're at? You're still grazing it fairly early in the year, or like here, a lot of that would be more like fall or winter grazing.
Yeah, we're maybe halfway through our second rotation on the grazing right now. So some of the ground that we hayed in the first cutting is getting grazed right now. And some of it, we actually ended up, we thought we were going to be really short, but we got about 10 days ago, a couple inches of rain spread over a week. It was almost perfect, probably spread half inch of rain at a time at night, sunshine all day. Grass took off. And so we actually have even made some second crop hay on some of these grounds that will be rotated into pasture on the third round. We can get 3 to 4, totally different, I imagine, than your area. Or in some areas, it kind of sounds almost nice, where you, all your grass growth comes at one time and then you just kind of stagger it. You just kind of graze the standing kind of cured forage, right? Is that kind of how that works?
That's talking about my neighborhood.
I had gotten dinner once with Kit Farrell when he was up talking in Wisconsin at an event, and he said, "You guys got it so tough up here." And I didn't really connect. I don't know. I think every area's got its, everything's got its unfair advantages and disadvantages. But he was saying, it's like, you know, we just, grass grows up, we graze it when we get to it. It's kind of that easy in big sections. You don't have grass growing up and fence lines shorting out fences all the time. You know, it's different challenges. Rain brings 5-foot grass that shorts out your fences and a whole bunch of weeds and thistle and all that stuff. But, you know, I think I'd still take my rain and a little more challenging grazing management than a complete destocking environment that stresses me out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's, I think Jim Garish's rule of thumb is one grazing per 10 inches of rain, you know, and yeah, that's pretty much right. And I would say most of our stuff is, like half of the acres, the second where we're getting 15 or 16. So we've got 1.5 grazings basically. Right.
Sure.
So, and I would say that half grazing for a lot of people around here is in the dormant season, you know, is a stockpiled kind of a thing. Because most of the guys around here won't start feeding hay until January or so. And then they'll feed through April.
What you graze early in the spring, will that grow back then? Is that kind of what your half graze in the winter is typically? It's still grazed briefly in the growing season before it's gone completely dormant, kind of a thing.
Like early on, it's grazed early on, and then it's grazed late as a stockpile.
Sure.
So,
and stuff grazed in July and August has just got one, just goes once
pretty much.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. We flip flop that then, so that next year that stuff grazes first in the spring, or
should, but I don't, I think most of it is, and I got in trouble because I thought I was sharing a post because I'm apparently a boomer, even though I'm a millennial by age. I was sharing a post on my personal Facebook page that I meant to share on the Working Cows page, and I said, "What did I say? Normalize not having pastures known by their named for their season of use. This is the way."
That's funny.
Back when everything had to end with "this is the way," but
everybody's probably got a calving pasture, right?
Right. I don't know. Yeah. Well, we still do. It's just the winter pasture, the summer pasture. That's kind of the two pastures a lot of people have.
Sure. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And So anyways, that I would say, no, I would say most of them are not starting at a different place every year. Yeah.
Sure.
Or
are they different forage types then? Do you see over time that grazing the same times of year leads to a certain plant species where other times of year leads to a different plant species?
See, I think we're so dominated by cool season grasses that it isn't that way. I would say our hay ground and our summer grass tends to be a lot of crested wheat because it can take a beating and it just never, you just really can't kill it. And, you know, Jim Garish told me the harder I graze it, the better it gets. So, you know, I mean, I think that's, just kind of the nature of that deal. And it's a decent forage. It's not the best. It's a introduced cool season grass. Be definitely better have a native cool season. It'd be even better to have native warm season. But, I would say it's pretty much, not necessarily a monoculture, but not very diverse pastures because they're getting grazed at the same time all the time. So,
interesting.
I think that is it. Mm. So, are corn stalks the key for you guys as far as extending the grazing season? Is there some actual dormant season grass grow or grazing that's going on for you through the winter? What's your winter?
I think it might be the biggest way. So we played around a lot with stockpiling perennials and stockpiling sorghum sedan grass. The idea was the sorghum sedan grass will be taller, it'll stand up in the snow and the crust better and stuff. And, you know, but then one year we had 70 acres of sorghum sedan grass stockpiled, and it got buried in snow and ice just like the rest of it. But instead of having just wasted crop residue, we wasted you know, an entire growing season on $300 an acre land rent, plus all the input costs to get that. I mean, there was probably $400 in costs into that sorghum sedan grass crop that we only harvested maybe 40 cow days an acre off of, and that's $10 a day. So there are $10. Yeah, that works out to $10 a day in feed costs essentially. And so that doesn't work. So after that, we were like, let's try, we've got this abundance of corn stalks. And if even sorghum doesn't hold up under the snow and the ice, let's just use the corn stalks as late as we can. We'll focus on grazing our grazing season, optimizing our grazing season until getting us to corn stalks. And then after that, we'll graze this crop residue. And as soon as it gets buried, it's buried and we're not out anything. You know, if we didn't get there at all, it was just going to get left, you know, anyway. So the challenge is in this area is finding somebody who's willing to, you know, be no-till and not turn it black before the freeze comes. So we've got one farmer we graze on until he can get to it for tillage. And then we move to a no-till. We're fortunate to work with a guy who's no-till. He actually reached out to us and saw the value of getting livestock on his land. And so we work with him after that and stuff. So that works out well.
And corn harvest is kind of mid October, November time frame.
Yeah.
And so exactly. You guys can get on there, onto that stuff that is going to get tilled. You can get on it, in the middle of October, November, sometime like that. And then you're there until he tills it. And then you go to the guy that is no till and you're there through January. Is that right?
We've the last three winters, we've been on that guy until January 20th was the earliest we've had to take him off. And I think February 2nd was the latest, something like that.
And any supplementation going on there? Any cake or anything
just,
like that?
Just salt and mineral. Salt. Okay. And actually since your chat with Steve Campbell, we've tried going down the salt road and stuff, so we've not even done mineral, but yeah, they're all stocks, no protein, nothing. So
gotcha. Yeah. And then they come home for bale grazing first part of February, something like that.
Whenever we have to. That guy's just 10 miles down the road, so we'll just keep an eye on him and check him, and as soon as the condition looks like it gets worse, we might feed him for a day or two until we can get over there with the trailer and stuff, but as soon, we'll just get him home as quick as we can. And then, so two winters ago was the first year we tried sending him south, and we sent all of our yearlings stayed up here on this neighbors, and all of the cows went down to southeast Nebraska. And so they went, and they've gone down there the last two winters, but you know, that way they stay down there until the beginning to middle of March. And that reduces our costs compared to hay as well. And we don't have to feed them as long, but the challenge is there's 500 miles each direction and trucking to go to, and with $6 diesel or whatever it is now, you know, it's pretty expensive to haul them. So I don't know if we'll continue to do that or not. You know, that we can graze, the question is kind of we can graze up here for 50 to 60 cents a day or whatever, and down there with trucking it works out to like $1.65, and now with the current mileage rate it was going to be closer to $1.90, so it's probably still better than feeding hay up here, but I don't know. We got to do the math and compare, I guess, does grazing at 50 cents till January 20th, followed by $2.50 until May. Is that better than grazing at $1.90 till March 15th and then $2.50 till May? We got to figure that all out.
Yep. So. Yep. And that is another thing. I think maybe we glossed over, or maybe it hasn't even been mentioned today, but you guys are calving in May. When do you start?
Yeah. May 1st, usually. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's, you're right. That's key to this whole thing. I don't think we could graze stocks with no supplement till the beginning of March and then put them on a truck 500 miles and calve a week later. That would be a failure.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. So, you've got $300 an acre land seeded to perennial pasture, and you're calving in May. Do you have any friends in the neighborhood?
Surprisingly, we're finding a few more all the time. But it's, I'm sure the people right around us look at us with, you know, questioning eyes, no doubt. I'm sure they would all, they're just waiting for the day when we go bankrupt, thinking that, well, it's only a matter of time putting that ground in the grass before I'll take it then and stuff. Yeah. So that's fine. They can keep waiting.
I've heard guys in Missouri say that bale grazing there is actually one of their strategies for managing mud, because if you pay attention to guys from Missouri at all, during the spring and the summer, quite a bit of the year, they're dealing with mud, and that increased organic matter from the bale grazing helps hold that soil structure together when it gets wet so that the cows don't pug it up and you know, go through the top of it and stuff like that. Have you guys seen any of that as far as your bale grazing, or is mud not as much of an issue in Minnesota because ground actually freezes?
Mud's an issue. We'll have to talk to them though. Maybe they've got some different way. I'd never even thought you probably don't have mud when you don't have any rain, but yeah, mud season is, I mean, it's rough. We don't have enough cement. Like if we had a bunch of cement, we'd probably feed them just for that, you know, 3 weeks of the worst of it or something, but we don't. So we just set aside a sacrifice pasture, but it's always ugly. I mean, it's, they're belly deep in mud sometimes and doesn't seem like there's anything we can really do. We try to find the dry, it's like the dry, you know, kind of sand, lighter soils that are a little, and old sods that'll come back and have a little bit more structure to them to hold them up and stuff. But yeah, so, you know, we try to find a lighter soil, you know, something that's got an old sod that'll hold them up a little better and stuff. But in that couple of weeks when, yeah, it freezes from the top down, so there's 6 inches below a hard pan, but just muck and water on top that can't infiltrate. And especially if it gets rainy, it's a real mess. But yeah, I'll have to find out from those folks down there how they do it, because they have mud all winter long almost, it seems like. They're kind of riding that above and below freezing line and stuff all winter. I don't know. That doesn't sound fun either.
Yeah, yeah. Like you said, everywhere has its unfair advantages and disadvantages. So
I believe that. I do.
I do absolutely too. And I think that, you know, kind of another thing that I've heard you talk about, as a result of attending Doug Ferguson's marketing school, was that, you know, we're not the victim, you know, we're not the victim of whatever you want to set up as the boogeyman that's coming to get you. You know, that we have an opportunity to take control of our situation and make a decision that fits our environment and, you know, find a way to work around whatever challenge, whether it's markets or Mother Nature or whatever, that is being thrown at us. And so I think that, you know, it's just a mindset issue. There is a way to fix the problem if you want to think about it and find a way to fix the problem, rather than just, you know, looking at the ground and kicking the dust. So,
That's actually the conversation I'm having after this one with Kit, is on excuses and how, you know, it's all choice. It so is, you know, I mean, if we didn't have this Faro Cattle Company market, you know, for cows, I think maybe Dad would have a different perspective, but as far as I'm concerned, I think the cows would be gone. It just doesn't make sense up here. And I talk to so many people who want cows, and I say, you know, I don't necessarily think you should do them, but if you want them, I'll sell them to you. But, you know, I don't think it makes the most sense in this environment, unless you can find whatever your advantage is. Maybe you've got access to a bunch of corn stocks, and there's some places in Minnesota I found where they can get hay for $70 a ton.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've not been able to, you know, I guess we've not been able to consistently here. So.
Right. Well, the quality that it's produced at and the competition, you know, those two things are going to drive the market and make it hard to come by, you know? So, here people start to squeal if they're paying more than $120-$150 a ton, and so last year and you know, we were seeing $250-$400 a ton, you know, out here, and so that was hard for a lot of guys, and so that's, you know, you just got to figure out. So what would the enterprise mix be if there weren't cows there? What would you, custom grazing, or what would you?
Yeah. Well, it might be the sell by marketing of Doug Ferguson, you know, that Wally Olson, Doug Ferguson school thing that intrigued me. I think there's a lot of opportunity in that. I haven't gone down that route yet. But the thing I think, you know, kind of our unfair advantage of this area is there's a lot of dairy farms and kind of that right size dairies, like the 500 to 2000 cow dairies and there's a lot of small ones too, like 100 to 200 cow dairies. There's some organic dairies and Arlanda certified organic. There's a lot of opportunity, I think, there. Where, you know, there's all the 10 to 12,000 cow dairies, they send all their heifers down to Missouri or to, you know, Arizona and stuff, but for finishing there. But these ones here, they find locals to custom feed, or they feed them themselves. And if their alternative is $3 a day and we can offer them $2.50 or $2.20 or something like that, that's kind of what we're trying right now. We brought in the last 2 years a group of 50 to 60 dairy heifers that I think that's got a lot of potential. They're one of the few, I'd say people who can value, maybe understand the value, because if you try to, a cow-calf guy who wants to custom graze in this area, if you say you got custom grazing, you'll have a bunch of people who are all interested until they find out you need $2.50 to $3 a day to justify keeping a cow-calf pair. They think that's ridiculous because they don't really know how much it costs to feed cows themselves. But the dairy guy who's already feeding $3 a day, if you can get him $2.20, he actually says this is a value. And there's data out there too that talks about, and I don't, it's maybe old data and stuff, I don't know how, if it's still true, I think it's 15-year-old data that talks about, I think a heifer grazed on grass has fewer foot issues and it milks maybe 2,000 to 3,000 pounds more in its first lactation or something. So it's actually increased value to the dairy farmer as well. So I think there's opportunity there.
Custom grazing heifer development.
Yep.
It's kind of what, I like that business model too. I guess kind of, as we point towards wrapping up, like you said, you got another recording to get off to, and I got a little bit of bonus content I'd like to capture with you.
Sure.
So one thing, I guess what I want to kind of look at the spectrums here, you mentioned that your dad went to New Zealand in the 80s and kind of, that initial seed of rotational grazing. And then I want to talk a little bit about the future. So how have things changed since your dad went to, he came back and implemented the rotational grazing. How has that system changed, or how has the approach changed since its implementation? But first, the first question I need an answer to is, what was the seed that, even planted in his mind that he would go to New Zealand?
Yeah. Well, you should have him on, because it's actually kind of a cool story, but we had a foreign exchange student. My grandpa's farm was very much conventional at the time in the 80s. They were farming like 1,000 acres, a couple hundred dairy cows, 100 beef cows, a few hundred sheep, all this ground in a very conventional feedlot type mindset. And we had a foreign exchange student from New Zealand come and it was cool. I actually was able to, I interviewed my dad on my podcast, and then I actually interviewed the foreign exchange student. I found him on LinkedIn. Cool. Haven't talked to him in 30 years or whatever it's been, and got him on and talked to him about it. But he came and he said, "This is ridiculous. Why are you working this hard? Y'all are 15 years behind us over in New Zealand. What are you doing this for?" And like, just totally challenged and questioned everything that my grandpa was doing. And my grandpa was wise, because he totally could have been offended. They were one of the biggest, most, progressive farmers of the area, really doing some pretty cool stuff. And he could have just said, "You don't know anything. You'll go back to New Zealand, whatever." But he told my dad, you ought to go over there and see what he's talking about. And so dad went over there for 8 months and worked on a couple stations over there, and kind of learned that, and came home and actually he went off, and started his own grazing dairy. My grandpa sold their dairy and kind of went the conventional crops and beef feedlot route. My dad started his grazing thing until 2000, when he came back home to the home farm and took over the home farm. And I guess to kind of lead on to your following question there, is what's kind of come from there is, in the early 2000s, when my dad sold his dairy and came here, he started trying beef and sheep and organic crops. The sheep left a couple of years later, and they didn't really fit the lifestyle at the time. And he focused largely, I would say, on organic crops. And then beef cattle genetics with Faro Cattle Company, and the grazing carried on in a pretty, good rotational grazing, not, fantastic. The crops were probably the biggest focus of his labor and time. I mean, he worked his butt off building this farm. Primarily large amount of the labor went to those organic crops. But in 2015, when I came home, we kind of both had the discussions and realized that both of our passions and enjoyment was around livestock and grazing. And at that time, around 7 years ago, we started focusing in on the grazing side and the livestock side, and adding more acres of pasture and expanding the herd, from the 120 or so cows we were at that point to the 220 we're at now. And now we're adding dairy heifers. And so, over the last 7 years, I would say the has been the biggest progression on the livestock side. And Yeah, we'll see where it goes from here. Now we're asking more questions. Ranching for profit forces you to do that, whether you want to ask the question. The answers to the questions maybe aren't the ones you want to know, but it's definitely making us think. And
From its implementation in the 2000s to now, where you're at, the grazing system is similar or pretty much the same as far as the infrastructure and then and the way it gets used. I was just wondering if that has that changed or adapted at all since he spent time in New Zealand to now.
I would say the infrastructure is largely the same. He built a lot of the infrastructure back then as far as water and permanent fence. We've done more subdividing with polywire, and we've got more of what was those organic crop acres that are in permanent pasture. We have more of the high quality tillable ground and pasture than we've ever had before. Like our farm has got, it's 300, we farm roughly around 750 acres total. And of that, probably 550 of it would be considered tillable. And the other 200 would be considered permanent pasture, like it should be in pasture. And for the majority of those years, most of that was in row crops or hay. Now it's kind of flipped to where 100 to 150 of it is in row crops and the rest is in some sort of a perennial pasture and stuff. So that's kind of been the biggest shift is, you know, switching those tillable acres over to perennial pastures.
Sure. And then the kind of the other end of that spectrum, you know, we were working on setting this interview up earlier and you said, you know, we had some chickens coming. And so what are some of the new things or what's some of the next things that you're trying? I mean, you mentioned the dairy heifers, but you got broilers that you're direct marketing and some of those things. What are some of the things that you're looking forward to or thinking about, or how has the introduction of broilers changed or what impact have you seen from that?
Yeah, well, kind of 2019, I got married in 2018 and my wife and I, you know, she wanted to be a part of the farm more and find some way to engage and be part of the farm and stuff. And we came across this family that was trying to get out of their direct marketing enterprise. And so we kind of took over their brand and their customer base and expanded from there. And they had beef and pork that they sold. And we sent out a survey to the customers and they wanted chicken. Everybody wanted chicken. And so we thought we better do that. And so we started with a couple Soliton style tractors. And now we've moved up to one of these big kind of mobile range coops that we can fit 600 birds in at a time. And we do 2 to 4 batches a year with that. And it's pretty neat to see another kind of, observation from last year's drought was the only green growing productive grasses where those chickens had been. They're depositing a lot of fertility on the ground and it's going to take a long time to cover a lot of land. I mean, we probably raised 1600 birds last year and covered 2.5 to 3 acres. So, you know, it's going to be years before we can cover it all. But, you know, if we can continue to expand that and raise, you know, have 3, 4, and there's this pasture bird company that raises 500,000 birds per year on grass. You know, I don't know if it'll ever be that big, but it would be a pretty incredible way to build pasture. And also it's neat because, I mean, it really doesn't affect much the grazing potential. I mean, you still graze that grass 2 to 3 times and stuff. So it's kind of an add-on enterprise that doesn't affect or reduce grazing potential, but if anything builds grazing potential with the fertility it's adding over time for sure. And it's probably definitely the most profitable per acre enterprise. So if we can figure out how to scale it as far as profit's concerned, the pasture poultry works really well.
Yeah. Yeah. It was one of the things I was listening to today on the way up here was you said when you can find those profit, when you scale profit, that's what's really exciting. I thought that was a good way to think about it. You know, you talk about 2 to 3 acres covered per year with your pastured poultry enterprise. Finally, an enterprise that covers ground more slowly than bale grazing.
That's the truth as well.
So
no, that was the downside of grazing stocks is we're not getting to improve our ground as much with bale grazing, but I think we're okay with that.
So. Yeah, very good. Well, what's coming up on the podcast? What are you looking forward to?
Well, I was telling you offline again, I'm always behind the game. I don't even know what I'm doing for next week yet, but I do. I've got Kit coming on next week to have this discussion around excuses. It's so easy to make excuses and and say this doesn't work because of X, Y, or Z, and never look at ourselves and the decision making that we're the decisions that we're making. So that's a discussion I'm looking forward to having here. But I've got a few repeat guests coming on. Dale Strickler was one of my more popular ones. He's going to come back on and talk about drought and cover crops and things like that. And got some other folks in mind that are just trying to set up a time with and stuff. But you know, it's going to be more discussions around producers and people thinking differently, maybe not differently from your listeners and differently from the people that are listening to this. In fact, it might align very well with them, but definitely different than mainstream. That's the goal. So,
yeah. No, I spent 2 or 3 years when I started this podcast saying we needed more cow-focused regenerative agriculture podcasts. And I don't think that we've reached the upper limit yet. Yeah. You know, I think there's still room in the game. So, you know, I always say these people that are in this space have more time to consume content than I could possibly create to meet the demand that they have. So, you know, they're out there fixing fence, moving cows, moving water, whatever, driving back and forth from place to place, mm-hmm. and they've got earbuds in and able to listen to something while they're going and redeem that time. You know, mm-hmm. so I think that I still think it holds true, but I really appreciate you for taking the bull by the horns and getting started and jumping in.
Well, no, it wouldn't have been as enjoyable, as fun, or as successful if you hadn't pioneered the way. So, Clay, I really appreciate you taking it on first and kind of building this group of listeners around this idea. So, thank you, and thanks for the help you've given me along the way too. It's been a lot of fun.
Sure. Well, all glory to God. Thank you, Jerry. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Yes.
Thanks for your time today.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
This episode's brought to you by Kubota, and farming demands well-built equipment. Kubota equipment that's proven for over a century. Tractors that are adaptable and versatile. Hay tools backed by a 2-year warranty. Sidekick utility vehicles where durability meets speed. And productive SSV skid steers. Visit your local Kubota dealer for a demo today. Very good stuff there. Obviously a very intelligent guy, very articulate, really enjoyed his perspective and talking to him about that. Very much looking forward to next week talking to Doug Ferguson. Doug Ferguson will be in Deadwood, South Dakota. I've promoted Deadwood before. We've had people come to Deadwood before for the Farm and Ranch Conference and promoting it again. Doug's going to be there for a conference, a marketing school. You can still get signed up for that. I think there's still room for that. You can get signed up for that at his website, MrCattlemaster.com. The dates on that school are September 25th through the 27th, September 25th, 26th, and 27th. The 25th is a social evening gathering, and then the 26th and 27th are the actual marketing school, and then on the 27th, the evening or afternoon of the 27th, I believe, we'll be finishing up with some ranch tours within my family tree. So really looking forward to that. We'll have more details and congeal that ranch tour as we get a little closer to the date, but it's going to be a good time. We got some exciting things going on. So would invite you to consider that. And next week, look forward to talking to Doug Ferguson. We're going to talk to him about just some of the strategies around marketing cattle. Last time we talked to him, I tried to talk to him about something that he hadn't talked about before in the mindset area. And this time we're going to talk to him about marketing cattle and some of the strategies and how we think about our approach to those things. So it'll be a good primer episode for the marketing school. Again, that's coming up in Deadwood, South Dakota at the Lodge again in Deadwood. Very awesome location. Great time of year to be there. Might even see some colors in Spearfish Canyon. September 25th through the 27th. If you're interested in that, you can find, as I said, more at MrCattlemaster.com. But we will talk to Doug next week for another episode of the Working Cows Podcast. We'll see you then.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.